Welcome back all to another installment of In Summation, The Final Word. And as always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. We're back this week to our standard format, though I do believe we will have the opportunity for another guest host show coming soon. More on that to come later. Thank you so much to everyone who reached out after the last episode. I know it was a bit long, but nobody really seemed to mind, and everyone seems to be a big fan of death investigator Joseph Scott Morgan, so I will definitely make plans to have him back on another episode in the future. But let's get to today's topic, which is going to be something we all think about, but perhaps have never really tested the limits of our knowledge on. Today we're going to talk about terrorism. There are two main categories of imagery that the word terrorism brings up. One is foreign invaders. A prime example of this is the September 11th, 2001 attack. Someone or some group who is not American, but who has some issue with America, perpetrates a violent act against civilians for the purpose of instilling fear in the general American public. The second is domestic terrorism. This is when an American citizen becomes so disaffected or disillusioned that they commit unspeakable acts of violence against their own fellow citizens. Usually, it's brought about by dissatisfaction with the government, or some belief that American culture is sick and needs a massive shakeup in order to survive. We're going to be discussing domestic terrorism today. We're going to look at how it can happen, how it's prosecuted, and what possible strategies are there to defend people charged with terrorism. What weight do those defenses carry? To tee up this case, I think it best to simply read the first paragraph from the prosecutor's opening statement at trial. April 19th, 1995 was a beautiful day in Oklahoma City. At least it started out as a beautiful day. The sun was shining, flowers were blooming. It was springtime in Oklahoma City. Sometime after 6 o'clock that morning, Tevin Garrett's mother woke him up to get him ready for the day. He was only 16 months old. He was a toddler, and as some of you know that have experience with toddlers, he had a keen eye for mischief. He would often pull the cord of her curling iron in the morning, pull it off the countertop until it fell down, often until it fell on him. That morning, she picked him up and wrestled with him on her bed before she got him dressed. She remembers this morning, because it was the last morning of his life. This is the United States versus Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh is perhaps the best-known domestic terrorist in American history. The bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building sent shockwaves through American culture. To set the scene, we had finished World War II in the 40s, gone through Korea and then Vietnam. The Cold War had created paranoia that the Soviet Union could destroy America at any second. People lived for decades, either under the harsh reality the United States was in an active conflict overseas, or with the constant and pervading fear of nuclear attacks at home. But then in November of 1989, that changed. The Berlin Wall came down, and the specter of Soviet world domination seemed to fall with it. The 1990s were largely a period of relief. There was the Gulf War, but it was nowhere near as destructive and politically contentious as Vietnam. In general, Americans were in the middle of a seven-year sigh of relief. Optimism was in the air, confidence was high, and Americans had eased into a feeling that the world was finally as it should be. And then the sun came up on April 19th, 1995. A Ryder truck rented 2 days earlier in Kansas pulled into the parking lot of the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. It parked directly under a second-floor daycare located in the building. At just after 9 a.m., a massive bomb exploded in the back of the Ryder truck, killing 168 men, women, and children. It wasn't long before authorities apprehended Timothy McVeigh. Around 75 minutes after the bombing, he was caught around 75 miles away, fleeing the Oklahoma City area. He was arrested on a minor traffic infraction and ultimately would be charged with the single largest loss of civilian lives in American history until the September 11th attacks. But who is Timothy McVeigh? Did he actually do it? And if so, why? Looking back, we have this almost metaphysical certainty that Timothy McVeigh was the Oklahoma City bomber. But at the time, was it really that obvious? Is it possible that he was actually innocent? The answer is no. We know with near metaphysical certainty that Timothy McVeigh did in fact blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. But we have to understand McVeigh's history to understand not only the why, but also the trial itself. McVeigh was born April 23rd, 1968, in Lockport, New York. He was the second of three children born to Mildred and William McVeigh. His parents divorced when he was 10 years old, and he went to live with his father. He had an exceptionally unpleasant childhood. He was constantly bullied. He was shy and introverted and suffered physical and mental abuse from bigger and stronger kids in his neighborhood and at school. This really seemed to leave serious psychological scarring on McVeigh, who would literally spend his entire life crusading against bullies in whatever form he found them. And perhaps as a result of his apprehension and anxiety around other people, McVeigh became an early adept user of computers. He used his high school's Commodore 64 to hack into government systems. And while his grades were generally poor in all other areas, he was named the most promising computer programmer of his high school class. Now, around the time he graduated high school, he started to become interested in gun ownership and gun rights. He briefly attended Bryant and Stratton College, but dropped out to become an armored car guard. At 20, Timothy McVeigh joined the military. He was in the infantry. Due to his obsession with guns and the structure he had been lacking his entire life, he did well. He was promoted to the rank of sergeant. However, his promotion allowed an uglier side of his personality to come out. My research indicates that he attended Klan rallies, was reprimanded for purchasing a white power t-shirt, and then was reprimanded again for assigning all the most undesirable tasks to the black servicemen under him. McVeigh longed for combat and celebrated when he was deployed to Desert Storm. He was awarded the Bronze Star, the National Defense Service Medal, the Southwest Asia Service Medal, the Army Service Ribbon, and the Kuwaiti Liberation Medal. He applied to join the Special Forces and was accepted to the selection program, but washed out on the second day, deciding then to leave the army. He was honorably discharged in 1991. Ironically, while serving in the military, McVeigh's distrust in the American government really started to blossom. After he was discharged, he told people that the U.S. government had implanted a chip in him so that they could monitor his movements. He joined extreme anti-tax and gun rights groups. He was a complete loner. He had no set home. He traveled the country with gun shows to make money. In 1993, another significant transformative event occurred, which probably set McVeigh more than anything else on the path which ultimately led to the death and destruction of Oklahoma City. McVeigh was traveling with a gun show and heard that the United States government was laying siege to a Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. He immediately traveled to Waco to show his support. The incident began when the ATF, the agency which regulates alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, attempted to serve a warrant on the compound to search for illegal stockpiles of weapons. The Branch Davidians elected not to allow federal agents to enter, and a nearly two-month-long standoff ensued. Ultimately, federal agents ended the standoff by storming the compound with tanks and tear gas, and a massive gunfight ensued. At the end of the day, 74 people lay dead, and McVeigh watched in horror at what he considered to be an oppressive government slaughtering its own civilians. The government, he would later say in interviews, was the ultimate bully. After Waco, McVeigh continued to largely live off the grid. He continued traveling for gun shows, sometimes stayed with army buddies and other anti-government extremists. He stockpiled weapons of his own and began learning how to make bombs. McVeigh recruited other ex-army anti-government extremists to his scheme, sharing with them his intention to blow up a federal building in Oklahoma City. The group broke into construction sites to steal blasting caps, went to farms to purchase tons of fertilizer to get ammonium nitrate, and rented huge storage lockers to manufacture and test their bombs. One of his closest friends started to get cold feet, asking him about whether there were any plans to make sure the building was empty before they blew it up. McVeigh replied that everyone inside the building was guilty because they were working for an evil empire. April 19th held a lot of significance for Timothy McVeigh. First, it was the date that the FBI stormed the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. It was also the date of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, marking the beginning of armed insurrection against the British government in the Revolutionary War. Around 9 a.m. on April 19th, McVeigh parked the Ryder truck in a handicap spot in the Alfred Murrah Building parking lot, walked to a YMCA parking lot nearby where he had stashed his getaway car. At 9.05 a.m., the Ryder truck exploded. Around 75 minutes later, the getaway car was stopped by Oklahoma Highway Patrol, roughly 20 miles from the Kansas border. The car didn't have a license plate, so McVeigh was pulled over. The officer then found a concealed weapon. McVeigh had no permit for it. McVeigh also wasn't carrying a driver's license or vehicle registration, so he was arrested and booked in Perry, Oklahoma, for these moderately minor infractions. While McVeigh was being detained in Perry, federal investigators were sifting through the rubble in Oklahoma City to uncover the VIN number of the Ryder truck which had blown up. That put them on the trail, which ultimately landed at the nearly 38-year-old man in the county lockup. McVeigh was subsequently indicted for the bombing. His lead attorney was a political activist named Stephen Jones. We're going to get to the defense strategy in a bit, but first let's quickly walk through the prosecution's narrative. Fans of this show will have heard me say over and over again that such a huge part of trial work is establishing and supporting a strong narrative. You want the jury to have a clear and easy to digest story, which ends up leading them to the result that you want them to arrive at. You want to keep it as simple as you can, and you want each and every question you ask and piece of evidence you submit to support that narrative. In some cases, the narratives are obvious. Sometimes the defense attorney argues that the police got the wrong guy, the mistakes were made during investigations, and the guy being put on the trial had nothing to do with the whole situation. Other times, it becomes impossible to argue that the defendant wasn't there, so the attorney will argue some sort of justification, a legal theory which will absolve the person of criminal liability while still admitting that the act itself was done. Most commonly, this takes the form of self-defense or something related to that. Now, while it may seem that a prosecutor's narrative is just the same in every case, the defense committed the crime for which he or she is now on trial, it is actually often much more nuanced and requires a good degree of finesse to do it correctly. Prosecutors are very rarely required by law to actually prove a defendant's motive for committing a crime. But juries will almost always want to know the why of the story in order to feel like they fully understand what happened and are comfortable convicting someone. Establishing that why becomes integral. And that's the narrative which prosecutors have a tendency to trip over. I've had cases where I've been able to convince juries that my client was not guilty because I could prove the prosecutor's theoretical motive was wrong. Let's illustrate this with an example, and this doesn't come from one of my cases, it's just a general example. Let's say that Matthew, a successful financial consultant, plans to rob a bank. Matthew's wife, Caitlin, works at the bank, but has absolutely no idea that Matthew plans to rob it. Matthew orchestrates a masterful bank robbery in all but one respect. and he's ultimately identified and tracked down from that one small oversight that he made. Now Matthew is looking at going to trial for bank robbery. For the most part, the limited evidence collected during the robbery is not all that conclusive. So there was enough evidence to identify Matthew as a suspect, but let's say it's not overly conclusive that Matthew is the bank robber. Let's also say that the prosecutor spoke to some of Matthew and Caitlin's neighbors and learned that they had had an argument a few days prior to the robbery. So the prosecutor develops a theory that Matthew robbed the bank as part of this conflict with his wife. But in reality, Matthew and Caitlin were fine. They'd had a minor disagreement, which was quickly resolved, and they had no real marital problems. In fact, they planned to go on vacation together and were meeting Caitlin's mother for dinner later that week. The reality is, Matthew had amassed huge gambling debts and was broke, so he was robbing the bank because he needed money. But when the prosecution tries to show at trial that Matthew was angry with Caitlin and robbed the bank in an effort to hurt her as a bank employee, it will easily be disproven. The prosecutor will sit there unable to explain to the jury why Matthew robbed the bank. And now Matthew has a much greater chance of being acquitted because the jury won't be able to reconcile the prosecution's assertion that he did it with their own internal questions as to why. All this is to say that motive matters, and the prosecutors have to develop accurate theories as to motive, or they will face unnecessary hardship getting convictions at a trial. The McVeigh prosecutors were actually quite lucky that McVeigh was pulled over driving a car without plates. Inside the car, which McVeigh was planning apparently to ditch in Kansas, not that far away, they found significant evidence that McVeigh was indeed the bomber. Everything from earplugs to shield his eardrums from the blast to a sealed envelope containing copies of magazine articles espousing deep anti-government views. When he was pulled over, he was even wearing a t-shirt which said the Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. There was also a business card in the car from a military supply store, and on it, McVeigh had written the price for TNT. So for the purposes of this podcast, let's accept that there was a good amount of evidence that McVeigh was in fact the bomber. That's not even getting into the fact that bomb residue was found on his t-shirt. McVeigh and his compatriot Terry Nichols were charged with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, use of a weapon of mass destruction, destruction by explosive, and murder. We've already mentioned that Stephen Jones was McVeigh's chief lawyer, the head of his defense trial team. The opening statement for the prosecution was given by wheelchair-bound multiple sclerosis victim Joseph Hartzler, who gave an excellent opening, depicting the evidence in an extremely gut-wrenching way without venturing over the line into argument and inviting objections. Hartzler co-chaired the trial for the prosecution with Larry Mackey, who delivered the summation. The prosecution narrative was clear and simple. Starting during his time in the military, McVeigh had become increasingly hostile towards the American government and had eventually made the decision to destroy a symbol of that government, a federal building, with no regard for the innocent people inside. The defense team was unable to really get in sync. McVeigh grew increasingly frustrated with Jones, as Jones refused to put forth the defense that McVeigh wanted to offer. Let's talk for a brief minute about the roles of the defendant and the defense attorney, and who controls what in a trial setting. Obviously, a strong relationship is a key factor in orchestrating a smooth trial, but what happens when a defendant wants to make an argument the defense attorney thinks is a poor strategic decision? There are actually only a few things that are solely the choice of the defendant, him or herself, in a trial. The decision of whether to go to trial or to plead guilty is within the sole discretion of the defendant, as is the decision about whether or not the defendant wants to testify. The attorney will give their opinions on these topics, i.e. whether a plea deal is favorable or fair, or what the pros and cons will be of taking the stand, and what the defendant is likely to face on cross-examination, but the defense attorney does not make those decisions. But all matters of trial strategy are up to the defense attorney. It is for the lawyer to decide what the narrative of the trial is and how to best put it forth. A defense attorney does not need the client's permission, for example, to argue a mental illness defense. In this particular case, McVeigh wanted Stephen Jones to argue a necessity defense. McVeigh wanted Jones to claim that the federal government had put McVeigh in imminent danger, and consequently McVeigh had to act to defend himself, and that's why he blew up the federal building. Jones rightly felt that this was utter and complete nonsense. I cannot imagine a scenario where McVeigh could honestly and convincingly argue that the federal government was putting him in such imminent danger that he was required to blow up a building of civilians in order to protect himself. Those are the desperate trappings of a severely mentally ill mind. But Jones did not argue that criminal liability here should be abrogated through mental illness. If you've listened to some other episodes of this show, you'll know that the standard for an affirmative defense of mental illness or insanity is actually quite high, and it's a hard bar to hit. Jones would have had to show that McVeigh was unable to appreciate the nature of his actions, or that what he was doing was wrong. And there is nothing about this situation which supported either of those contentions. So the insanity defense was a non-starter. So what could Jones do? He had a client who planted a bomb that blew up at a building, killing nearly 170 people, almost 20 of whom were toddlers in a daycare, who was legally sane and believed that his actions were in fact justified. So Jones came up with a novel defense idea for mitigation. There are times, as a defense attorney, when you know that the evidence is there to convict your client. But you also know that there may be information out there that you can present to the jury, and that the jury might soften their opinion of your client, even if they're still going to convict them. If the defendant was abused as a child or has a history of mental illness, even if it doesn't rise to the level of criminal insanity, you may still tug at the heartstrings of some jurors. So Jones feverishly investigated McVeigh's life and past. His goal was to shift the perception away from McVeigh being at the top of the conspiracy pyramid to putting McVeigh in the middle of a much larger conspiracy, making him into a soldier rather than a leader. He looked into whether McVeigh had ties to Arab terrorists, or if any of the white supremacy groups that McVeigh had fallen in with could be considered a vast terror network, planning more and bigger acts of violence. Two things happened which dealt a substantial blow to the defense shortly before the trial began. First, the Honorable Judge Richard Matsch, who was presiding over the case, heard arguments from both sides about the existence of a larger conspiracy, where McVeigh was merely a lower-level soldier, and Judge Matsch deemed the evidence too sparse to present to the jury. So that defense was out. Now, this is an interesting point. A lot of people believe that a defendant is free to argue any defense that they want to in court. That's not the case. In certain situations, a judge will require the defendant to offer a preview of what they want to argue to the jury and explain the evidence they have to back it up in a pre-trial hearing. The judge will then decide if the jury will get to hear anything about that defense. If the judge decides that there is simply not enough evidence to establish that the defense is viable, the judge can preclude the defense from ever even raising it. This saves time and resources and prevents the jury from hearing confusing, extraneous information. Now, the second thing was that a member of the defense team made a massive accidental error. They were trying to leak some of the FBI reports to the press. They provided the Dallas Morning News with a computer disk. The leaker did not realize, however, that the disc also contained some notes regarding attorney-client conversations that the defense team had had with McVeigh. On the disc was a document where one of the defense attorneys had recorded notes from a conversation with McVeigh, where McVeigh indicated that he had set the bomb to go off just after 9 a.m. to maximize the body count. This exploded on national media less than a month before jury selection. As a defense attorney, this is basically the worst thing that could possibly happen when you're preparing for trial. Jury selection went on March 31st, 1997, lasted just about 3 weeks. Jones, with his ability to argue for a larger conspiracy denied by the judge, decided to employ one of the oldest and most common defenses that you will see in a criminal trial. Now, that doesn't make it ineffective, but it's common. The investigation was shoddy and simply focused on my client to the exclusion of evidence that other people did it. Jones argued that the government investigation into the largest mass killing in America to date lasted all of about 2 weeks, and then the next 2 years were spent simply trying to force all the evidence they'd collected to point towards McVeigh, whether it naturally did so or not. Jones claimed critical evidence was ignored, witness statements conflicted with each other, and the descriptions of the bomber didn't match McVeigh at all. All told, the prosecution put up 137 witnesses. Now that sounds like a lot, but remember, many of the people who testified were family members of the bombing victims who were not actually fact witnesses. Now, you'll remember we discussed earlier that there was a friend of McVeigh's who got cold feet towards the end of the bombing strategy session before the bomb was actually planted. He and his wife both testified against McVeigh. While Jones was able to land some blows on cross-examination, the fact is that both witnesses were able to give a detailed look at McVeigh's actions for months leading up to the bombing, explaining his behaviors and the steps that he was taking in preparation. And there is no question that these two witnesses had baggage. They had trafficked in guns, taken copious amounts of illegal narcotics, initially lied to investigators, helped wrap blasting caps, and they'd even forged driver's licenses for McVeigh. But at the end of the day, all of that only made them more credible, because it really showed that they knew exactly what they were talking about. These two became the key witnesses at the trial. Of the 137, they had the most effect. And the third most effective witness would have been McVeigh's sister, Jennifer. Jennifer was subpoenaed and forced to testify about McVeigh's transition from being merely a vocal critic of the government to a militant bent on violence. She very reluctantly testified about his knowledge of explosives and rants about government overreach. The defense put on 25 witnesses of their own, though only one of them really presented much for the jury to think about. Dr. Friedrich Whitehurst testified for McVeigh. He was an FBI lab technician. His testimony concerned contamination, and in substance, he said that the FBI had woefully inadequate measures to prevent the contamination of evidence for this type of situation, and that when he evaluated the evidence in this particular case, he felt there were clear areas of potential contamination. He could not, however, point to any single piece of evidence and say this particular thing or that particular thing should be disregarded and then give an explanation as to why. He could only say that the processes allowed for contamination and explain how it could have theoretically happened. At the end of the day, arguments for potential contamination couldn't explain the bomb residue on McVeigh's shirt at the time he was arrested. The verdict in this case was basically a foregone conclusion. The jury deliberated for around 23 hours before convicting McVeigh on all 11 counts he was charged with. McVeigh received the death penalty and was executed in 2001 by lethal injection. In summation, here's my personal opinion on the evidence at the trial. Had this trial been closer, The FBI tech testifying for the defense would have been truly significant testimony, and here's why. Scientific data is often relied on by jurors, perhaps more than it should be. Jurors, and people in general, feel comfortable trusting the science. How many times have we heard that phrase over the last 2 years? Trust the science, follow the science, believe the science. There is no question that there are times when the science is wrong in criminal prosecutions. And not maybe wrong, but misapplied or misunderstood. Things like contamination or a misreading of reports can lead to the wrong conclusions. Prosecutors tend to rely heavily on lab reports, chemist reports, and the like. Obviously, the prosecutor is unqualified and incapable of running these tests themselves, so they are required to rely on the competency and expertise of their tech people to ensure everything's done correctly and that the evidence does in fact say what they're claiming it says. When an offense attorney can create some doubt about the prosecution's scientific evidence, it creates a bigger than normal rift. If the prosecutor is wrong on the science, the thing which is supposed to be unassailable, what else might they be wrong about? As it was, by the time this testimony came out, the mountain that McVeigh would have had to climb to get a not guilty verdict was already insurmountable. It was too little, too late. This is through no fault of Jones, who did admirably for the little he was given to work with. Had this trial gone differently, had there been slightly less damning evidence, maybe shakier cooperator testimony, stronger evidence that credible leads had been ignored, this testimony from Dr. Whitehurst may well have struck a resonating blow with the jury. And that kind of leads us to the elephant in the room. Trying a domestic terrorism case. I suppose you can consider us fortunate as a society that terrorism trials are incredibly rare. But certainly they do happen, and they bring elements into cases that your average federal trial does not. The first is sensationalized media coverage. We've all heard the old news media adage that if it bleeds, it leads. Newspapers, cable news, even social media sites are driven by eyes on the page or links clicked. The truth is often a victim of the desperate need to have something more attention-grabbing than everyone else covering the same situation. That's already a problem in local media. But when you expand that out to national media on a case which grabs national headlines, it becomes harder and harder to find people who aren't already so tainted by that coverage that their minds are made up. As recent as 1995 feels, individual use of the internet was just starting to get going, and media companies were slugging it out for dominance. This case was everywhere. And let's just say that very few articles were focused on the shoddy investigation or holes in the evidence. And second, when you throw the word terrorism into a prosecution, most people will abandon the traditional American mores of innocent until proven guilty and proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The prevailing view is that terrorists simply don't deserve the same treatment as everyone else. And here's why I personally find this idea so deeply concerning. In McVeigh's case, the evidence, I think we would all agree, was pretty convincing. They were able to trace his purchase of bomb components, his knowledge of explosives, an identification of him as the person who rented the van, his flagrant anti-government thinking, even his conversation with the defense team that he had set the bomb off at a specific time to maximize body count. This case did not leave McVeigh's team with a whole lot to work with. But that isn't always going to be the case. It hasn't always been the case. We cannot claim to be a beacon on a hill society if we're going to pick and choose who gets a presumption of innocence and who doesn't. If it doesn't extend to everyone, then it effectively extends to no one. We're seeing this play out a lot today. Certain groups will label defendants who they have moral or political disagreements with as terrorists in an effort to delegitimize their beliefs and signal that these particular people do not deserve the benefit of innocent until proven guilty. If we're being honest with ourselves, we've seen this more and more prevalent over the past few years, and it's a disturbing trend. I know I say this all the time, but I'm a systems and institutions person. I believe in systems. I believe in institutions. I think they all work best when we all buy into them and we commit to their efficient functioning. But there is a threshold where, if enough of us balk at the system, it will simply cease to function the way we want and need it to. And when we talk about the institution of criminal justice, that will mean that the basic foundational principles of due process will erode into memories, while the loudest voices on Twitter call for public executions of the holders of disfavored ideas, regardless of their actual innocence. It's for precisely this reason that every case has to be weighed on its own merits, and why every defendant has to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt before they can be punished. I'll probably talk more about this either in an article or a later episode, as we're running out of time for this installment, but I absolutely think that Twitter is the most toxic environment on the planet. And I'm sure that for some institutions it's useful and beneficial, but when it comes to criminal justice, nothing is doing a better job of bringing the system down and burning it to the ground. Here's some final thoughts on McVeigh. He strikes me as an incredibly difficult client to defend. And not because he was guilty, most clients are, but because he had such strong views about his case and how it should have been handled, and those ideas were nonsense. Strong-willed clients who are so certain that they know how to handle their own strategy tend to be the most difficult. The most idealistic clients are the hardest to convince of anything, even when it's clearly in their best interest. I think Stephen Jones did a beyond admirable job of maintaining client relations with someone who was clearly volatile, executing his strategy, which was certainly superior to arguing that the government had backed McVeigh into such a corner that he had to bomb a building full of women and children, and coming up with plausible defense ideas. Jones had originally wanted to argue that it was in McVeigh's nature to sacrifice himself for the cause. If you looked at his military record, there was ample support for that. He was many things, but he wasn't a selfish man. He put the mission ahead of himself. Now, that was obviously tainted by what his mission was. And that's not to say that he had admirable qualities in this regard, but just that he possessed the quality. Jones wanted to argue that McVeigh was a cog in a giant machine, and that he was going to do his part for the sake of the machine, regardless of what happened to him. That could have garnered just the edge of sympathy from maybe a juror or two, which may have been enough to escape the death penalty. Unfortunately for Jones, that idea became closed off to him when the judge ruled that he could not bring up the idea of a larger conspiracy. The leak of the defense notes to the media was unconscionable. The idea that anyone on the defense team would accidentally leak out the absolute most damning piece of information in existence is really troubling. It would have been like if one Spartan had been standing alone on the bridge of Thermopylae, set to defend the bridge against a million Persians, and then he had tripped and cut off both of his arms while falling. Again, had this been a case where more doubt was sewn into the fabric of the proceeding, it would have mattered more. But we can't overlook the error done here. Anytime a defense attorney is speaking with the media, they have to be incredibly careful about what they say. You have to make sure you're not violating any court orders, betraying any confidences, giving away any strategic information, or making claims which will later come out that you can't back up. And it goes without saying that you should double and triple check any files that you provide to anyone outside the defense team. That careless error basically solidified a conviction. Now, it was a conviction which I think we would likely agree, looking back, was going to happen anyway. But the job of the defense attorney is never to make the prosecutor's job easier. We don't know which member of the defense team made the mistake, at least I couldn't uncover that in my research, but that's probably for the best. 3 months after McVeigh was executed, planes were flown into the World Trade Center. And McVeigh no longer was responsible for the largest single loss of life event in our nation's history. Because of that, and with the passage of over 25 years, people still remember hearing the name Timothy McVeigh. But I think a lot of people don't remember necessarily that he was the Oklahoma City bomber. They don't remember how he shattered the national sigh of relief and optimism. That confusion, that feeling of how could somebody do this, was almost wiped away by the events of 9/11, when all those feelings were ratcheted up to a new level and refocused by a death toll which significantly multiplied that from Oklahoma City. But I do think the McVeigh case is an important study, not only in who gets to decide the defense strategy or what not to send to a national media outlet, but to set the benchmark for what actual domestic terrorism looks like. McVeigh bombed a building full of civilians to use violence and fear to send a political message that the government of the United States was evil. That's domestic terrorism. We would do well to remember that. So that's the show for Timothy McVeigh. If you enjoyed the breakdown and analysis of the case, check out the remainder of the show's catalog. If you want to make a suggestion for a case or a topic to cover, or send feedback of any kind, feel free to email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, even though I hate Twitter, I will check it. Or you can look me up at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Special thank you, as always, to my audio engineer, Dan Townsend, who handles everything I throw at him and makes me sound better than I do in person on every episode. I also want to say a thank you to all the listeners who've reached out to voice support or send feedback so far. I really appreciate hearing from all of you. And the few suggestions that I have received, I'm plugging in to my list for upcoming episodes. So thank you. If you enjoy the legal analysis without the culture wars and the blue team, red team posturing, then I hope you enjoy this podcast. Thanks for stopping by. And then I hope that you'll come back for more.